Okay, good morning, Professor Surlas. Thank you very much for sitting down with us. As we've discussed ahead of time, the theme of this interview is the formulation and understanding of replica symmetry breaking, which goes roughly from 1975 to 1995. But before we dive into that subject, I'd like to ask you a few questions on background. First, can you tell us a few things about your youth? And what eventually got you to study physics?
So I grew up in Athens in Greece. And I studied engineering. In fact, I finished an engineering school in Athens. And then I decided to, I didn't like very much the practical things, practicing as an engineer, so I decided to switch to physics. And I came to France at that time, to Orsay. And then I started, I mean, in France, we have what's called a DEA. And I started a DEA in Orsay doing physics, and I was in high energy. I was in high energy. And that time, when I was in Orsay, my first year, Daniele Amati, who at that time was at CERN, came as a visiting professor. And I started working with him. So Amati was collaborating with Bouchard and Gervais in Orsay. And when I left, when he left, I continued to work on high energy with Gervais and Bouchard. And then in 74, the group moved to École Normale Supérieure. So I moved to the group to École Normale Supérieure. So since 74, I am in École Normale Supérieure. So,
Nicolas, can I ask you why you decided to move to France from Greece? Why France and not another country? I mean, did you have any connection? Was there any special connection between Greece and France? Or
no. The thing is, I had a degree in engineering. I wanted to do physics. So I applied to a couple of the best universities in the US. Of course, I needed a scholarship and I was turned down. So in France, engineering degrees are appreciated. So I was accepted in France. And that's how I came to France. And so I'm coming back. So I was a high energy student. And in, 72, in fact, I think it was 72, came out the Wilson-Fisher paper on epsilon aromatization group. Sorry. Oui? And so people started studying the paper, and was, I remember Paul Martin was visiting Saclay at that time, I'm sorry, and he gave a series of lectures. Completely ununderstandable on phase transitions and the normalization group. So, but I got interested into the subject. And then the turning point was summer of 73. Summer of 73, there was a very important summer school in Cargès on the normalization group, organized by Bresin. So this played a very, very important role in Europe for the dissemination of the ideas of the Romanization group. And you had people like many, many people, Kadanov, Elliot Leeb, etc., lecturing at the school. But the most important, at least for me, the most important figure was Ken Wilson. So I don't know whether you know Cargés. At that time, all the buildings did not exist. So students were camping on the grounds of the school. And professors have rooms in the hotels in the village, with one exception. And the exception was Ken Wilson, who was camping on the grounds of the school with the students. The other exception was that, so the other professors were doing their lectures and then, went to their hotel or something. So Ken Wilson was there all the time and talking to students all the time, giving private lectures, private seminars. So it was, we had dinner at time almost every day in the village with Ken. And he was on the peak, of his career. And it was really, really impressive. So he gave, of course, his class, but his interest at that time was lattice gauge theories. He was developing lattice gauge theories. And the paper, so this is summer 73, July 73. The paper is 2 years later. And he given lectures on everything. Asymptotic freedom was very recent. He had his ideas about quark confinement, who were developing at the time. So very, very recent. And he was talking about projects which did not finish, like fully developed turbulence. I think so. He was really, really impressive. And this decided me, after finishing my thesis, to go to Cornell for a postdoc. That's how I decided to go to Cornell for a postdoc. I would mention another participant, another professor to this to this Cargés school, whom this is the first time in my life I met Giorgio Parisi. Mm. Because Giorgio Parisi, he was 25 years old at that time only, but he was a professor at the school. I was a student. Giorgio was a professor, by far the youngest.
So was he camping or was he in a hotel?
I think he was in a hotel.
Okay.
Or in a room. All of the he was living in the village anyway. I don't know, but we had several discussions, and Giorgio was very, very much interested. We're discussing also other subjects than physics. And Giorgio was very much interested in what was going on in Greece. At that time, there was the dictatorship. Mm-hmm. And I discovered that he knew Greece much better than I did. He had traveled already at that time. So we were discussing a lot of time about Greece. And what I discovered much later, I mean, probably Francesco is not very familiar with that, but the older generation, say Giorgio's generation and the other generation of educated Italians, have a very, very profound classical education and things like that. So maybe in this respect, Giorgio was not so, but he was exceptional still, I mean, but this was fitting with the Italian tradition. I mean, and so after that, I went as a postdoc to Cornell. When I finished, I went there in the fall of 75. And just for your amusement, I should say my first encounter with Wilson at Cornell. I knew him quite well already from Cargés. So he said, "What are you working on?" At that time, I was working, it was a fashionable system. The subject was semi-classical approximations. This was very, I was working on semi-classical approximations. I explained to him, and he said, in his usually frank way of speaking, he said, "This is no point." He said, "I have tried a few years ago, and I convinced myself, at least so for high energy physics, this is not a useful tool, something, so you should look to something else." And then, I don't remember when it was, this time or another time, he suggested me the following subject: you should look at the breaking of symmetries in lattice in gauge theories. This is the interest subject which you should look at. So you know what is the symmetry, the pion symmetry, that the pion gets is the Goldstone boson, pseudo-Goldstone boson of chiral symmetry. So you said, he said you should look at chiral symmetry breaking. So fortunately, I did not follow his advice, because I think until today, the subject is not very, very well understood. So that's about, I mean, so you should, so Ken was given series of lectures on lattice gauge theories, which everything, I mean, most of the material was not published. Mm-hmm. And if you look retrospectively, since that time, what were the major contribution to the subject, none came from the students at Cornell at that time. And they were extremely bright students. I was very impressed, I mean, of the quality of the students. Michael Peskin, for example, was very, very impressive. And so, and there is an explanation for that, that all of the contributions people get credit for since that time, lattice gauge theories, were already in Wilson's class. He had made all of those contributions himself, but he never published. So it was not possible, say, to write a paper, say, from a student at Cornell, from something that was already taught in the class.
Okay. So after your time at Cornell, you came back to ENS, to the LPT?
Yes, I came back.
And as a CNRS member immediately?
Yes, I was already CNRS.
Okay.
CNRS member before going to Cornell. Because time, I should add a thing which would amuse some people to show what the situation was very, very different at that time. When I was a first year graduate student in Orsay, somebody comes to my office and he says, "We have a job for maître assistant at the university, and no candidate. Would you accept the job?" Could you tell that? But so that's I got my first job without being a candidate. And then the next year I was accepted as CNRS, where I didn't have teaching obligations.
Mm-hmm. So in notes you sent us, you mentioned that you first got, you got to work or got to know Giorgio Parisi more when you came back to the LPT, ENS.
Yeah.
Did you immediately start working together? And if yes, what was the program? What was the program?
So we knew each other already from Cargés. Mm-hmm. So the first contact was easy. And as Francesco knows very well, the contact with Giorgio regarding scientific matters is extremely easy. So we start talking something. So the first thing we work was exactly trying to understand the fermion doubling problem in lattice gauge theories. But as many other people, we failed. So nothing came out of that. And then we did the work with Drouf on the mean field theory, say, of lattice gauge theories, which means studying lattice gauge theories at a large dimension. And this is the work which was published. I mean, it was not the first work we published together, but the other one is some phonology work I won't mention. So, but this turned out to have importance because at infinite dimensions, we found that there is a phase transition in lattice gauge theories, and the new phase is that of branch polymers. Yeah. In branch polymers, we have that. So you have this phase in lattice gauge theories. And it turned out that few months later, after we published this paper, came a paper by Lubensky and Itzekson, a Fischer of Letters, studying branch polymers. And they claim in this paper that the upper critical dimension was 8. For branch polymers. So this made Giorgio extremely excited because Giorgio had an intuition. And I think, you know, if you do the high temperature expansion, the diagrams for spins are lines. For gauge theories, which is the same as surfaces, the diagrams are surfaces. And you go from lines to surfaces by doubling the number of dimensions. So we know that the upper critical dimension for spins is 4. So Lubensky and Isaacson were claiming that for branch polymer is 8. So this was fitting exactly this intuition. And this make Giorgio extremely excited. And furthermore, if you extrapolate, you could say that this is true also for the lower critical dimension. For spins, the lower critical dimension is 2. So this would mean that for gauge theories or random surfaces, it would be 4, the lower critical dimension. This would mean that there was no phase transition at 4 dimensions. And this would mean that quarks were confined because there was no phase at 4 dimensions. So the problem of quark confinement was one of the major problems in physics. And this was a very strong hint that there was no phase transition, so engaged theories in 4 dimensions, and that confinement was true. So for that reason, so at that time, Giorgio was mostly interested in high energy physics, in particular engaged theories, and so he became very, very, very excited about that.
Can you tell us a bit how you were working with Giorgio? Would you two meet every day, or how? Just a bit about how that went on.
Yes, he had an office, so we were meeting, have lunch together. But Giorgio had many interactions in the Pario area in parallel. So he was also interacting with people at Saclay, for example, Isaacson, Brezin, and other. Even he wrote a paper on semi-classical approximations with Ballion and Voros. So he had many interactions. So some days he went to Saclay, some other days. We had very regular. And we came to the subject of branch polymers and the Lubensky and Isaacson paper, Giorgio was back in Rome at that time. So he was regularly writing letters to us, trying to say what he had done, trying to understand the paper of Lubensky and Isaacson. But this was an impossible task. The paper was completely unreadable. And after some time, he gave up. Because there was no way to, but this had the important, I will come back to the later to the branched polymers, but this Lubensky and Isaacson were using replicas. That's how Giorgio confronted the replica problem. And then he read in the literature that replica symmetry should be broken. And then this was his motivation to start to understand replica symmetry break. So his motivation was from the problem of branch polymers. Now, the thing is, as probably you know, we wrote a paper, Giorgio, on branch polymers. So how did it come? At that time, papers were just circulating. So if somebody was writing a paper, he was sending a preprint to his friends. There was no archive. No. Mm-hmm. So, At that time, he was new in École Normale. Gérard Toulouse was new in École Normale. He came from Auxerre. And I was interacting with him. And Toulouse was a friend of Lubensky. And I saw on Toulouse's desk the long paper, because up to now, there was only the Fizeref letters paper, which was very short and completely incomprehensible. So I borrowed the paper, the long paper, and tried to, which was more explicit than the letter, but still not very understandable. More explicit, but not very understandable. And then by accident, I was going by that time to a conference in the US. And I decided to stop over in Philadelphia, where Lubensky was located. And I think he's still in in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And so I have prepared all questions, everything which I did not understand in his paper. And we had a session in the morning. And I asked, we discussed all those questions. And then my understanding improved a lot of the paper. But this did not solve the problem. So then after that, I was for 1 week or something in Rome, coming back to the US, and explained to Giorgio what was going on. And what was going on was kind of disaster, because Lubensky and Al made a change of variables in the replica space to have propagators which are diagonal in the new variables, because in the original variables, the propagators were diagonal in a replica space. But by doing so, the price they were paying, they got a coupling constant proportional to 1 over n, where n is the replica, the number of replicas. So in perturbation theory, did not have any meaning. So if you have coupling constants, which are 1 over n. And then did elaborated perturbation theory calculations and found out that the final result, at least in the first step, the singularities were canceling out. The 1 over n singularities were canceling out between the different graphs. And then, so we decided to sit down to understand. This convinced Giorgio that something serious was going on. And then you reformulated completely the problem with non-diagonal propagators in the replica space. So there were no singularities. And we recognized that this was the random field problem, changing variables, the random easing, but in an imaginary, with an imaginary external field. So we knew that from our previous work with the random, that there was supersymmetry in this model, a dimensional reduction, which was explaining the shift of dimension by 2 units. So understood the result was correct, but for other reasons. And in this way, we were able to find the exact critical exponents in 3 and 2 dimensions. So in 3 dimensions, I think up to today is probably the only problem in physics one where you know the exact value of the critical exponents. Also, but so this is the origin of the interest of Giorgio, the replicas.
So in notes that you sent us, you mentioned that your first encounter with the ideas of replica symmetry breaking were in Carget in 79 as well, that same year. Is that where you also first learned about spin glasses? And can you detail a bit what was going on then?
So this school was on high, essentially on gauge theories. So there was nothing about spin glasses in this school. And so this was, they were mathematically minded people. So there were many mathematicians like Sir Michael Atiyah or Singer or other famous mathematicians participating in this school. And so the only person who was familiar with spin glasses and replicas, participant in the school, was Gérard Toulouse. So Gérard Toulouse had already been working with spin glasses. Probably before that, I have talked a couple of times about with Gérard Toulouse about spin glasses. And probably I should mention that Gérard Toulouse had been familiar with lattice gauge theories also. And the reason is funny. You know, one of the first papers on lattice gauge theories in France was a paper by Ballion, Drouf, and Itzigson of Saclay. And this was the thesis of Drouf. And Gérard Toulouse was a member of the thesis committee examining Drouf. He had studied, he got familiarized with gauge theories. So, because he was a serious person, so it was a new subject for him. So he learned the subject, he studied the subject. And you know, after that, there are a couple of papers by Toulouse where he makes the connection with gauge theories. He talks between spin glasses and gauge theories. And this is the paper where I don't remember the exact reference, which he introduced the notion of frustration. And I should mention another thing. You know, if you do spin glasses, the approximation, so the annealed approximation, you know, this is very bad approximation because the ferromagnetic state gives the biggest contribution to the average. So, Toulouse got the idea to force out those contributions, to define a modified annealed approximation that put a gauge coupling, gauge plaquette coupling, but with a negative coupling constant. So the negative coupling constant has as an effect of banning all unfrustrated plaquettes in the average and enhancing the contribution also of frustrated plaquettes. And he made this suggestion I think it was Guy and Banot, some collaborator, don't remember with whom they were, those people who were doing numerical simulation for lattice gauge theories. And he simulated with these ideas and established phase diagrams following the suggestion of Toulouse to show that the connection also between, yes, was already starting to be in there. And coming back to Cargés, so Giorgio gave only private talks, essentially to Toulouse and myself, about his replica symmetry breaking scheme. But he was very anxious to interact with mathematicians. He knew that his proposal was mathematically unorthodox. And as I said in the notes, I remember a memorable after dinner discussion with Raoul Bott. Raoul Bott was professor of mathematics at Harvard. Unfortunately, he's not anymore alive. And Giorgio asked him, can you define a matrix with zero elements? And so in the middle of the Mediterranean night, Raoul Bott was thinking how mathematically rigorous defining matrices with zero elements, but he was very positive in his reaction. He was not at all negative. And then Giorgio asked, can you define the permutation group of zero elements? And he said, this permutation group should be an infinite group. And then he said, for the following reason, that if n is equal m1 times m2, the permutation group of n elements has some, as subgroups, the permutation group of m1 elements and f2 elements. So n0 is equal to m times 0. So all the permutation groups with finite elements should be subgroups of the permutation group of zero L. But this was too much for, as I remember, for Raoul Bott. And also it was late in the night, so and the discussion stopped somewhere around that time.
So what was your reaction to the ideas of replica symmetry breaking? How did it look to you as a theoretical physicist at that point?
So as a miracle. But this was not the first miracle coming out from Giorgio. So I was not shocked as other people would have been. I mean, there were many, many conjectures. I mean, it would be too technical. I mean, in field theory, lattice gauge theories, Giorgio had made, which they were not for somebody else than Giorgio, were not very difficult, not very easy to understand. Why should things be this way? But all the times, it turned out that he was right. At that time, there was a leading field theorist in Europe named Kurt Szymanczyk. Kurt Szymanczyk is not alive anymore, but as this may seem strange, because the styles are completely different, Kurt Szymanczyk was a very good friend of Giorgio. And when Giorgio was making his wild speculations, sometimes wild speculation, which were backed by computations. I mean, wild speculations. So in field theory, sometimes later, Szymanczyk was confirming that this speculation is correct. And I should just give an example how some of those speculations, I don't remember the details, were based. You know, at that time, people were doing extremely complicated calculations, field theoretic calculations. And I asked once Giorgio, how did you come to this conclusion? And he said, look at this paper, this completely ununderstandable paper by some Russian authors. You know, at that time, there were some papers with very obscure calculations. But you say, if you take this paper, and if you change this as an hypothesis in the beginning or something, you will get this conclusion. How was he able to go through this Russian paper? So there was, I mean, it was not simple intuition, I mean, but he had some other arguments to justify his, but this was from somebody else. For example, so in this he was, well, maybe this is not the place, but I would like to quote another case. Once I was, this was about spin glasses, and I went another visit to Rome, and Mark Messar, we'll come to Mark later, had done some calculations and asked me to bring the calculations to Giorgio in Rome. So immediately, Giorgio looked at the calculation and made a conjecture what the results of the calculations were. And then he had to do some properties to just in order to justify this with some special functions. So they were sitting in a room with Miguel, Giorgio, and myself. So Miguel takes the book of mathematical formulas, something of special functions and something. And then he says, your conjecture is not correct according to the book. Here I have the book with the properties of the mathematical function, and your conjecture is not correct, he says to George. So Giorgio becomes angry, takes the book and says, the book is wrong. And then he turns the pages, the previous pages, and he found other formulas, and he displays that there were contradictions among the formulas in the book. So he had so strong intuition, something that he was able to claim that the book, I don't remember, was the Bateman or one of the classical books of special functions. He had enough confidence to say that the book at this point was wrong.
So you started working on replica symmetry breaking ideas a few years later. And in your notes, again, you mentioned that Claude Bouchia suggested you work with Marc Mézard on these ideas, right? So
this was before. Okay.
So what convinced you to jump on this bandwagon? And do you know what was Bouchia's motivation in suggesting you pursue this?
No, Bouchia didn't have in time spin glasses. I think he had in mind statistical physics problems in general. And for example, the first paper of Mark, so I should say that Mark was a high energy PhD student with Claude Bouchard, who was his advisor. And I don't know the reason. I suspect there are some reasons why Bouchard suggested to Mark to change subject, but I think that the personal interest of Bouchard has shifted. But this is a conjecture of mine. I don't know what the reasons were. But the first statistical mechanics paper of Mark was not this one, was not on spin classes. In fact, we start working together. So I suggested him a problem which he did by himself. There was a conjecture by Toulouse and Lacour-Gaguet that for random, the large n limit for random fields, there was dimensional reduction. Mm. But the paper of Toulouse and Lacour-Gaguet was qualitatively, and it needed some better, more rigorous, so the problem needed a more rigorous treatment. And that's the first paper, as far as I remember, that was the first paper Marc Mézard wrote. He did this more rigorous treatment, and he wrote a paper on that. And since probably this was his first paper on statistical mechanics. Mm. To come back to your question, what factor made me and other people jump on spin classes? And this, was a seminar Giorgio Kay gave in the fall of 82 in Bur-sur-Yvette. Because Giorgio was visiting often. And this seminar was before the publication of the paper of the physical meaning of replica symmetry breaking, the existence of several quasi-equilibrium states and their distribution in configuration space. And he was making the connection between real configuration space and the replicas, and how you could compute properties in configuration space of the physical system using replicas. And this paper was published later, I think in 83, maybe in the spring of 83 in PhysRep Letters, which is, to my opinion, an extremely important paper. Because up to then, replicas were just a magic trick to compute things. But this shows that it had a deep physical content. And this make us I remember Bernard Derrida being participating in this seminar, how excited he was after that, and other people. And so I decided that I should get serious about that. And the replicas was not just a technical thing. And we started. So by that time, Miguel Virasoro, a little bit late, came as a visiting professor to Econ Normal in Paris. And he was sharing an office in École Normale with me. And we were discussing a lot, and we were discussing what to do, what problem, Toulouse came with his enthusiasm about this paper of Giorgio, and also we were very excited. But Miguel had never worked on statistical mechanics before.
Mm-hmm.
So out of those discussions, he decided to start to look himself. So we start, the three of us, essentially, also discussing with Toulouse from time to time, and discussing and doing computations. So to find out the consequences of, this Giorgio paper. And Miguel, from time to time during the weekends, he was visiting his family in Rome. And then at this occasion, he went to see Giorgio and tell him what we were doing. And Giorgio turned out he was most of the things he had done already by himself, alone, and he started, and we started communicating, and we were telling the results of own computations, and Giorgio was telling us what he was doing. So at the end, we came up with a paper, with in fact, two papers. So on the where we have discovered the ultrametricity structure of the space of spin glass states, and also the absence of self-averaging on the order parameter. Which was, I think this was wrong to be considered as a big surprise. And the reason I'm saying that, in the 78 Lezus lectures, in his lecture, Phil Anderson says that it's not at all obvious that self-averaging should be correct, and people should look at violations of self-averaging. But I think by that time, Phil Anderson was the only one saying that. And So
could you give us a bit of a flavor to how the work would proceed? So you said Mark was working with you. So would you assign him computations, or would you do computations in parallel to vary? How would that work?
In parallel. But we were seeing each other every day. With Miguel, I was sharing the office, and and also we had the interaction with but I should come back to the paper of Parisi on the physical interpretation of replica symmetry breaking, and I should insist very much on that. But even today, I know several and even famous people who have not understood the significance of this paper. One, of course, who understood it immediately was Phil Anderson. That's why, in my notes, I insist that the text of Phil Anderson to be included, as I have it in my notes, to be included, because I think is the best explanation I have seen for the importance of replica symmetry breaking, and that the fact that's a new things. I would rephrase the things with many, many years later that we knew about scenarios of phase transitions. The first scenario was, I would say, Landau scenario, phase transition, where you have spontaneous symmetry breaking, and for example, for the ferromagnet. The later scenario was Kosterlitz and Thouless, and also there is a Russian physicist, I don't remember his name, who did it independently at the same time, and which is the topological scenario phase transition. And I think Giorgio's contribution is a new paradigm of phase transition, where there is nor symmetry breaking, nor topological order. So this is really, I mean, something really new and important. And we say, and this gave applications to several other domains outside the field of physics, like optimizations or computer science, or even you take the Hopfield model, for example, something. And this, I think probably Anderson was the first to see that things would be this way. And this paper was so important that you would have applications to those other fields. And I should add another thing. So I met Anderson for the first time in the summer of 85. At that time, he had not yet written, but he had done his paper of graph bipartitioning with Fu. And in his paper, he had shown that there was a connection about the optimum solution of the graph certain graph bipartition problem with the ground state energy of the scale model of spin classes. And you had two completely different methods. So for spin glasses was the replica symmetry calculation of Giorgio. And for the graph bipartitioning problem, there were calculations by computer science and numerical simulations. And Anderson realized that two numbers were coinciding. And this, as he told me, this convinced him that the solution of Giorgio was correct. And this was in the summer of 85. And this played a certain role because if Anderson says he's convinced about the correctness of the solution he has. So I would say that this was, Anderson probably was a very important singularity in the community, in the condensed physics community at that time. So first thing is that the paper, FISREV letters, did not, I mean, Giorgio had big difficulty in getting his paper accepted in his rev letters. And we suspect who was the referee, but I mean, I would not say that, but the reason we're suspecting, but he was insisting on many references on his own work. And finally, Giorgio wrote a letter to the editor of his rev letters saying that the referee should not be allowed all the time to ask references from himself. And then the editor replied, the point is well taken. So he's a very well-known person in the community, this referee. But so just to tell you, yes, and I know other people, very, very famous people, who did not believe to the solution. Bernd Halperin, for example, have discussed with him at that time. He was not the referee. But there were other people. I mean, one person, yes, maybe I should add that, who seems hesitantly convinced was David Thewlis, another important person so in the community. And the reason I'm saying that, he was, both him and Giorgio were present in a winter Lesus school, who was, you know, it was a workshop, not a school, organized by Brezin, Toulouse, and Gervais. And that time also for the, they were, you know, at that time, an active group on spin glasses, particular experiments, so in Europe, was in Grenoble. And there was a speaker from Grenoble. I'm not sure who he was, probably Sulti, who presented the first version of the droplet mode. So according to him, so the people in Grenoble were calling that le modèle de nuages, the clouds model. And they were giving paternity to the model to Nell. Apparently Nell had, probably they didn't, he didn't have the detailed scaling picture or something, the new exponents or something, but the idea, the intuitive idea, apparently Nell had this idea. And Thewlis turned down this for the following reason, that if you look to the magnetization, to the zero field Coulomb magnetization as a function of temperature, if you cross the transition point, the magnetization becomes experimentally essentially flat with respect to the temperature. And what Thewlis was saying, first of all, Thewlis was saying, if you have a paramagnetic phase, you should follow the 1 over T curve down to zero temperature. So experiments are incompatible with this. And on the other hand, Giorgio was predicting that. His replica symmetry breaking was predicting that. So Thewlis said that this paper seems arbitrary, but the only experimental prediction it makes is that about this is the only prediction experimentally testable which makes it is about the magnetization. So, and this seems compatible with experiments. So just to show you, because you asked me what the reaction of the community was. So there were a few people, not Thewlis is not the ordinary condensed matter physicist, no, neither is Anderson. But, mm-hmm. but I think the rest Also, I think in the US, the reaction was pretty much negative. I mean, because but maybe I'm wrong, but I would say the condensed matter community in the US is less speculative, less mathematic, abstract minded, less than it is. So, with exceptions, of course, with notable expansion. Just an anecdote also. Phil Anderson was coming out from a condensed matter conference in the US. When I saw him in the US, I said, this was on high TC, something. And we said, what is the impression, your impression from the conference? I asked Phil Anderson. And you say, you know, those people don't know the difference between a pole and a cat. This typical Phil Anderson comment.
So I think at about that same time, you developed an interest for computer simulations. Is that? Yes. Can you tell us how you got to first work and think about this as a tool?
The motivation was that there were some predictions of Georgius' theories, which were not taken seriously by the other people who do the simulation. For example, the absence of self-averaging for the order parameter or the ultrametric structure. And then that was my motivation, whether it's... So this was not taken seriously. The people were just doing average over disorder and trying to locate the phase transition and like, but what the structure of the low temperature phase so did not interest people doing simulation that time. Maybe I do say an exception was a paper by Peter Young, who for the SK model tried to compute the P of Q, the thing. But maybe you ask me this question, I'm not prepared to answer in detail, but that's my first reaction to your question.
Okay. I mean, because I'm asking also because at the same time, there were special purpose computers that were developed, by Ogielski and co-workers. So yes. What was your reaction to this? Or?
But again, this was interesting work, but again, he was focusing on the average result existence of phase transition computation of exponents. So, but not on the phase structure or something of the low temperature phase, which turned out to be a very, very difficult problem, of course.
So
I would add the comment.
Yes.
And that what was, in fact, George's comment at that time. So he said, take the example of the Heisenberg model in two dimensions, or n model, n different from one and from two also. We know that there is no phase transition at this model. There is no phase transition in two dimensions. But if you go I mean, the correlation length goes to infinity at zero temperature in this model. And if you look at properties at length scales smaller than the correlations, yeah? For example, here's finite systems with sizes smaller or other things. So what we'll find some pictures consistent with mean field theory. So we know that mean field theory is not correct because there is no phase transition in those models in two dimensions. But yes, and I think this has been verified later by François David, who did some field theory calculations. And if I remember correctly, now I have to look, it turns out that this was correct. So that if you are looking to scales, so you know that the correlation length goes to infinite. So for at zero temperature, but if you look to finite temperature, but at distances smaller than the correlation length, which could be arbitrarily large, then what you find, there are things which are compatible with the mean field theory. So my philosophy was, we don't know what happened. Maybe, yes, even at low enough temperatures, but not below the infinite volume transition temperature, you could see things similar to what is predicted by mean field theory.
So to move on to the next topic, you subsequently moved to the study of optimization and error correcting codes. So how did this how did you identify the connection between this topic and spin glasses? And then how did the error correcting code community initially react to those ideas, to this connection?
So first of all, I learned about error correcting codes from a seminar, John Hofield, at the Collège de France. John Hofield had a neural network model for error correct codes. And John Hofield, at that time, he was on Caltech. And you should know, I mean, what I discovered much later. So talking to the experts, that all the theory of the essential theory of the error correcting codes was done, was finished already by the end of the 50s, something. So people in the community thought this is a beautiful theory, but useless. Because nobody was using it. And the situation changed with the Venus of space extrapolation with satellites, because you made a tremendous saving. Otherwise, you should have put a lot of power on the satellite to communicate without error correct codes. And weight is money, because you have to lift something much heavier. The space, you need much more money. I don't remember the number, but people were saying that using error correcting codes, you could save up to $100 million per satellite. So things like that. So that's where, so all the error correcting codes, first of all of the space program in the US, the first years, was managed by Caltech, the Jet Propulsion Lab. And at that time, John Hopfield was a professor in Caltech. So he, as he's a curious person, he was talking to those people. He had friends in the Jet Propulsion Lab. So that's how he got introduced or something interesting to the error correcting. And if you see the reference he gives, it was a reference of Caltech people in his first paper. So I discovered the subject. So in the seminar of John Hopfield, who, as usually, he's a very, very bright speaker, very enthusiastic. And he communicated to me his enthusiasm. And then I made a connection in my mind later on with lattice gauge theories. And I thought this a new way of doing, you know, that if you have a, for example, a pure gauge theory, spin model, you know, by gauge transformation, you can get the ground state, what is called the Matisse model. And then the idea was to use as error, as a to transmit the couplings of the Hamiltonian instead of transmitting the there is a connection, one-one correspondence between bits of information and spins, which is a trivial correspondence. But instead of transmitting the bits of the spins, transmit the couplings of a Matisse Hamiltonian. That was the original idea. And then there were developments around this idea, building dictionaries from spin Hamiltonians to the thing. But so I thought that this is pretty new formulation of the problem, and I was very enthusiastic about that, but I didn't have any feedback from so my paper, for mysterious reasons, was accepted in Nature. It was published in Nature, but despite that fact, I don't think it had, there were very few people who bought the idea. I should give credit to Bill Bialik and as one of the earliest to be converted to idea. But Bill Bialik was a physicist, was not. Later, I discovered myself that what I was doing was not different. This was not a new approach. It was a new thing, but the codes you get were not new codes. And the reason was, if you look at what people were doing, I mean, the Hamiltonian I proposed was the logarithm of the probability. So if you transmit some bits, and then you get the probability for a sequence to be true given the output of the channel, of the transmission channel. And in fact, mathematically, what I was doing was equivalent to that. I mean, which I had not realized from the very beginning that was I was doing. But as I said in the notes, I mean, in France, it was impossible to get, even after that, to get in contact with the information theory community. So for that reason, I had a colleague in Paris who was the director of the high energy lab in Jussieu. His name was Pronob Mitter. And I talked to the problem. He looked at the paper and he said, look, he sent the paper to his brother, Sanjoy Mitter, who was the director of our most important information theory labs in the world. He was at MIT. And the lab, the name of the lab is LIDS, which still exists today. So Sanjoy Mitter invited me for 1 month at his lab at MIT after reading my paper. And then this was the first real contact with the communication theory community. And I mean, I gave a series of lectures on the connection. And then, so I have first to explain statistical mechanics, disorder systems and things like that. And the people were completely ignorant of the subject, but very much interested and very, very great curiosity, intellectual curiosity. And they were finding the connection very excited. And this encouraged me a lot. And encouraged me a lot. So after that, I continued, understood better what I was doing and the real connection, what people were doing. In fact, already in this first visit, I met Gallagher. Gallagher was co-director of this MIT lab. He's a very famous person in information theory and a former collaborator of Shannon. and he was very, 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 very enthusiastic. And this encouraged me a lot. So I continued, and then I made a second visit. In the meantime, I have understood many more things. And in this second visit, people were very excited in the communication theory because of the discovery of new error correcting codes, which were empirically much, much better than the ones were used in before. They were called turbo codes, and the other ones were called LPDC, low density parity check codes, which were in fact the codes discovered in his thesis by Gallagher, but which have been people have forgotten Gallagher himself. When I gave my talks, he says, this maybe have some relations what I have done in my physics. And again, this is just an anecdote. Gallagher had a patent on his codes. And the patent was owned by a company, I would say like that, which had been bought by Motorola. So the patent, Motorola was the owner of the patent of those codes, but they were so much discouraged about those codes that a few years because of the rediscovery, they have given up the patent. They did not renew it. And so I'm coming back to my second, this second visit. So I was convinced, I mean, people knew that these new codes work because numerically simulations, they were extremely good. Even, I don't know the actual status, but the turbo codes have already been adopted for mobile phone communications. I don't know now whether they change or they still use turbo codes for in the new protocols for yes, but people knew that they are very extremely good, but there was no theoretical understanding why they're good. And I thought the methods of statistical mechanics could improve on that. So it came back motivated to understand whether this is true or not. And by that time, when I came back, there was a nice surprise. Sergio Caracciolo from Scuola Normale in Pisa asked me to take one of his brightest students as an intern. I said yes. So this intern was Andrea Montanari. And he hadn't finished his thesis. His thesis was again on lattice gauge theories. So you see lattice gauge theories coming again and again. And I convinced him to look with me to those new codes in parallel with his thesis, because he needed to finish his thesis on lattice gauge theories. And after some time, he was extremely fast, extremely good. So he didn't know the disorder system physics at all, but he learned extremely fast. And you solved the problem of turbo codes. You found that it was a phase transition, and at least in the replica symmetric approximation. So once I presented that in a conference, and then there was, I have met in my second meeting another very important person in this coding community. His name is David Forney. So I discovered later that he was the first in history to have conceived and construct a model. So he has done that in 68. And that time there was no market for modems. So he told me that they could sell some of them only to the Pentagon, because the Pentagon was interested in modems. So, okay, at that time I met him, he was vice president research of Motorola. But he was very influential. He had a big prestige. I mean, he was a student of Gallagher himself, and he had a very well known in the communication, because he had big contribution on error correcting codes himself. And he got very much excited about the connection with statistical mechanics of disorder system. And I think if the method, this now has been adopted by a large fraction of the community, and this is mostly due to David Forney. because so influential in the community. And then we decided to organize a workshop. So with physicists and theorists of communication theory, we organized in 2001 a workshop in Trieste. And there were tutorials, two tutorials in physics and two tutorials in communication theory. The tutorials in physics I had invited because there was the only physicist. And I had invited Parisi and Messard, who gave the two tutorials on disorder systems. And he had invited MacLeese of Caltech, who unfortunately is not any long live. And David Mackay, also who was a very important person, who unfortunately is not alive, although much younger than us. He was not alive anymore. But this made all the idea, the conventions, I mean, known to a wider community. And that's how the methods of statistical mechanics in communication theory has spread. I should make a comment here. Sometimes I'm having arguments with people from either for optimization theory or for optimization thanks and something. They said, what is the contribution of statistical mechanics to the field? Eh? Please. And so, and quite often there are people with negative attitude come in, but all of them acknowledge that there is a big contribution, which the realization that there exists a phase transition in many of those problems. So those people, those communities, did not know the existence of phase transitions before. And that's the first time they discover, and so they acknowledge, even the most critical ones, they acknowledge that this is a major contribution in their fields made from the methods of statistical mechanics. And then with phase transitions, you have all what we know in statistical physics about phase transitions. Those people did not know about, for example, finite size effect, critical slowing down, or the existence of aging, and glassy dynamics, things like that, which they discover in their algorithms. So the algorithms share this behavior thing. And I think this is a big contribution of statistical mechanics to those fields. And up to the point, I didn't verify the last year, but you know, there is the big annual conference of communication theory organized by IEEE. So I don't remember the official title of this series of conferences, but they have introduced a special session in those conferences on the methods of statistical mechanics. So, which shows the acknowledgement of the contribution of statistics. It's not only error correcting codes, I should say. I mean, there is the works on for example, KSAT by first days, Kirkpatrick, Monasson, Zecchina, and then also Bezar and Al. I mean, but there are, was that an example or the, so there has been a very important cross-fertilization. I mean,
so in between your Nature paper and the Turbo Code paper, you worked mostly on your own on those problems, right? Was it difficult to recruit physics graduate students at that point to be interested? How was it, seen as too esoteric from the physics lens?
Yes. So I had, because Andrea Tate sometime. So I was not alone. So Andrea was recruited. I mean, he didn't want to postulate, but I convinced him to postulate to a SNRS job. And he postulated, and that's an interesting, another interesting story. I mean, the year he postulated to two commissions, so two fields. So in SNRS, one was the theoretical physics commission, and the other one was the information theory. So, and but not only information theory and computer science. So this was a particular year because the government had decided that computer science was a maximum priority field. And so there were six positions for theoretical physics, and I think 66 for computer science and information theory. So he had a very strong recommendation letter, which I saw from David Forney, was one of the most well-known people in the field. So despite that, he was refused from the computer science community, but they didn't have enough candidates to fill all the 66 positions they had. And despite that, they refused Montanari because he was an outsider. What they said officially, he has not published in our journals. So in the physics community, they classified him sous la barre, as we say in French. It means they were six positions and they classified him as seven something. And with the justification, he's so good that we should not waste one of our positions. He should be taking his candidate to the other commission, so he should get the post from the other commission. So as a result, he was not accepted officially. So there was a big, I made a big fuss about that. And then the director of Ecole Normale knew the director general of SNRS, and he told him about that. And the only legal way to hire Andrea, because there exists, was a decision of the Conseil d'Administration of SNRS, which is the highest government bond. So you sidestep all the normal procedure. So Andrea was hired at the end by the Conseil d'Administration of the Senate. This seems completely baroque. I mean, but okay. So he didn't stay. I think he stayed 7 years or something like that. He did excellent job, and then he was so good. He was hired by Stanford. So he's a professor at Stanford. Mm-hmm. But he was not good enough for the computer science commission of the CNRS.
So throughout all those years, you've kept on working with Giorgio as well. How did that collaboration continue, and how did you remain interested in spin glasses and the RFIM models?
Yeah, I'm interested in Giorgio. So we had some open problems, and from time to time when we meet, which unfortunately is not very frequent nowadays, we discuss about that and then making some suggestions, doing some computations and numerical simulations and try to understand their meaning or something. So,
okay.
So, and I don't know if people know well enough Giorgio or not, but I mean, he's always very interested in physics. And then if you talk about new fields or something, you have some idea or something, sometimes you transform your idea to, to be a nicer one or something. And then, I mean, fraction. Yes. So until hopefully there will be a new paper coming out.
During your time at ENS or elsewhere, did you ever get to teach about Rebecca symmetry breaking? And if yes, in what context?
So ENS, I think the only place I taught about replica symmetry breaking was MIT. Mm-hmm. I don't remember any other.
And these were special seminars, or there was a course, formal course?
A course. So maybe 10 courses or something like that, series of 10 courses. And this was in the electrical engineering department of MIT, not in the physics department of MIT. Also, I gave, now I remember, then the reaction was rather negative at there was a research institute in Princeton by NEC, the big Japanese company. I mean, they had a very active research lab, and I gave series there. Then people who were more mathematically minded at that time, I mean, we didn't have the, this was 1991. It was not proven that the theory was correct. And because in a co-normal something, we had many younger people doing the teaching, and it was got good. And we were particularly fortunate to have particularly bright young students, like, well, he's not yet very young anymore, but that time He was young, Marc Mazzariu was young, Rémy Monasson was young, and so those people. Also, Bernard Derrida did a lot of teaching because he had a job of professor. But his point of view, although very similar or something, he was not, his main focus was not the replica symmetry breaking, I think.
Is there anything else about that era that you would like to share with us that we may have overstepped or forgotten?
I have to look back to my notes, which were more thought about. So this is oral. So in the oral, you miss thing. Ah, yes, one thing, yes, which I would like to stress was that those years has been a very strong European community. I mean, we had European programs and you had other things. This started with some personal relations. For example, Toulouse knew well Sherrington from the old years. And then there was this Lesouche schools and the Lesouche, which played a big role. And then people from Heidelberg had some extra money and they organized a couple of very important workshops. Then I didn't mention here, it's my written thing, there was Giorgio organized in 81 a workshop in the Accademia dei Lincei in Rome, which is it's very vivid in my memory, because during the coffee break, we heard a very strong gun noise, and then there were sirens of police cars and things. So we didn't know what going on. Later we discovered was the attempt to kill the Pope in 81, which was during a coffee break. So the meeting was in Accademia dei Lincei, which is not very far from the Vatican. So you can, in an afternoon, you can hear those things. But I'm coming later years, for many years, they have been European networks or other things, programs every 2 or 3 years, we were postulating for a new program, and we got many of them. And the money we got was spent on a conference or postdocs positions like that. And I should stress the importance played by David Sherrington, who all those years he was the overall coordinator, and he did a really very great job. So the Italian coordinator, you should have people from all the countries. The Italian coordinator was Giorgio Parisi. The German coordinator was Heinz Horner from Heidelberg, and John Hertz for the Scandinavian countries. And so we had several meetings young people going as postdoc positions to the collaborating labs. And so this has been a very active community and which played a big role in the for the subject in Europe. I mean, and I think most of the contribution of this are coming from European labs on this subject.
In closing, unless Francesco has any other question, in closing, do you have any, have you kept any of the notes, papers, and correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
Fortunately not. Fortunately not. And as Francesco knows, we have, I had many times I have to change office. So the most recent thing is, I mean, 1 month ago, something, and we had, I had to throw away a lot of my notes or something because of lack of space in the new office and things like that. So I was not, unfortunately, I was not careful enough to realize the importance of keeping archives.
Well, thank you very much for your time and
thank you very much.
Conversation.
Thank you very much. But you will write down some, yes?